Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, snack lovers. Curb your cravings with My Mochi ice cream. Imagine a scoop of rich, creamy, premium ice cream in your favorite flavor. Now imagine that scoop wrapped up in the sweetest, softest dough known to mankind. That's My Mochi ice cream. Sweet, chewy, cool, and creamy, all in one bite. It's quite possibly the most joyfully chill sensation you've ever had in your life. My Mochi ice cream comes in tons of fabulous flavors, like strawberry, mango, cookies and cream, and double chocolate. Each box of My Mochi ice cream has 6 perfectly portioned mochis that are about 80 calories each, and it's also gluten-free. You can find My Mochi at Target or visit MyMochi.com to find a grocery store near you. That's MyMochi.com. Discover the joyfully chill sensation of My Mochi ice cream today.
Hey, welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 356. I just got to London, and I'm a little wiped out after traveling, so this might be a very quick intro, which is probably okay in your book. Hey, do a lot of stand-up. Go to the Nerdist calendar page. Hey, there's a YouTube channel. Go to the YouTube Nerdist page. Hey, there's other stuff. Look it up. I would like to thank sponsorship on this episode of Nerdist Podcast from LegalZoom. America was built on invention. I'm going to say everything was built on invention. I'm pretty sure America did not invent invention. I can't prove that, but I'm going to go out on a limb. Now, if only there was some World Wide Web of Information that could support or refute that, then great. But until that happens, you may be an inventor. You may want to create something. So this month, LegalZoom is celebrating innovation by making it easier to innovate. File a patent application, protect your invention, incorporate a business, form an LLC, and then get help with trademark and copyright applications and more from LegalZoom. They've helped customers file for over 100,000 trademarks and helped tons of businesses get started right. Just visit LegalZoom.com. You're going to get answers to some straightforward questions. They're going to take care of you from start to finish. Celebrate innovation with LegalZoom. For a limited time, get a special price on trademark, copyright, and patent applications when you enter Nerdist in the referral box at checkout. Protect your creations and launch your dreams at LegalZoom.com today. LegalZoom can provide self-help services at your specific direction, or they can connect you to an independent attorney, but they are not a law firm. LegalZoom.com. Now, this episode is Fits of the Tantrums, which is a band that I like, and they're nice. So Fitz came on, and he was a really interesting guy, and then even after we stopped recording, I just grilled him about his background after I found out what his dad did, which I'm not going to spoil now, because then you don't want a spoiler for the podcast. Just listen. You'll get to it. But the new Fits and the Tantrums album is out now. It's called More Than Just a Dream, and pick it up. Here's Nerdist Podcast episode number 356. With Fitz and the Tantrums, parenthetically, maybe "and the Tantrums" are just parenthetical because it's just Fitz. Fitz and the Tantrums, minus "and the Tantrums." No tantrums, just the Fitz, ma'am.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Internet has emboldened everybody to have way too many opinions.
Bring your mother into it. It's weird.
Yeah. And your family and your dick, for some reason, they'll challenge.
So we don't have to be clean, right? We
can
dirty words.
Yeah. Please. Yeah.
Because I got a trucker's mouth.
That's good. Okay, good. The podcast could almost be called Trucker's Mouth.
I still like, and no one asked, but this is very specific.
Yeah. No, this is very specific, and I know no one asked. Most of our stories are it's very much just a loose conversation. Fitz, and now there don't seem to be any tantrums here.
No, we left the tantrums at home.
Is that? Are they like, we want to come? And you're like, your tantrums, you stay here.
No, I think they were like, what, we don't have to work today and you do? Go for it, buddy.
You have to go talk for an hour?
Exactly.
So your album, well, by the time this goes up, your album will have just come out.
Yeah, that's right.
So congratulations.
Thank you, brother.
You did it.
We did it.
You released your album.
10 million copies sold.
Oh,
well,
man.
Done, sir.
Remember those days?
Oh, my God.
Remember when everyone had Taylor Swift numbers?
Or Adele? And it was like, and if you sold any less than like 5 million, it was like, fuck off.
I know. And now you sell like 150,000 and they're like applauding you.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's so crazy to look at the charts and see like what makes number one some weeks. And it's literally, you could sell like 45,000 records and be in the number one position on the charts.
Do you even think about any of that stuff anymore? Or is it like, what's your gauge for success, or do you have one, or is it a personal one, or is it a numbers one?
I mean, that, you know, for me, that's like multi-layered, because for me, like, you know, I busted my ass in the music business for almost 20 years and I could not get fucking arrested to save my life. And I picked up and put down the dream so many times, and it was really only when I was like 36, 37 that I even got my first break. After I had finally come to peace with, okay, this is never going to happen. Just deal with it. What else are you going to do with your life? And then this magical moment happened where it felt different than anything else I had ever done. And it was sort of like, I always say it was like, before it was like trying to smash a square peg through a round hole. And then with this band, with Fits and the Tantrums, all of a sudden it was like, it just flowed. And there was these serendipitous moments that kind of like kept feeding off of each other. So for me, every moment that this band exists and I actually get to pay my bills from doing music, it's like, you know, I've already like achieved every dream I could have ever wanted.
Well, what do you think the shift was? Was it just this specific collection of people that was just like, oh, well, this isn't, you couldn't engineer this. It just kind of happened.
Well, obviously, I think, you know, you got to have good music. You got to have talented people. There's definitely like some exceptional musicians in my band. And what we do is we put on a real live show. You know, it's like there's no smoke and mirrors. Everybody is so talented. And when you put the six of us together, there is this palpable energy that's translated. But I think it's also my drummer, John, he always talks about this, you know, theory of like, you're in line. And if you get out of line, you got to get back to the end of the line. But if you stay in line for your dream, you just keep plowing it away at it. Eventually your time is going to come around. So his theory is, don't get out of the fucking line.
don't get off hold when it's like, your call's very important to us.
Exactly.
Although the business never really says your call is very important to us.
No, and you know, that was the thing, is I think, you know, I had done a lot of music for advertising and for movies and stuff like that, and made a little bit of money from that. And I basically, when I saw a couple glimmers of like, maybe something's happening, I put my whole entire life savings into this band. And we, you know, we were able to go tour the country and open up for bigger bands and stuff. But it was only kind of with that original investment that we could even afford to go across the country and do all this stuff. And we sort of just built up this following to the point when we were ignored by the industry the whole entire time. And then it just got to this point where finally we had built up enough of our fan base that the industry finally had to start taking a little bit notice when we were selling out shows across the country and being like, what's going on? These guys don't even have a record deal and they're being talked about like social media all over the place and selling out shows. So for me, it was like, and the rest of the guys and gal in the band, it's really a point of pride that we built it all on our own. And sort of everyone ignored us and we're like, okay, you're going to ignore us? Well, F you, we're going to go do it on our own anyways.
I think that's really sort of the MO of being in any kind of artistic endeavor today is not, I mean, you know, I'm sure there was some degree of that before, you know, before the 90s and in the 80s and the 70s, and where it's like, oh no, you got to keep plowing ahead. But I think it was a lot harder back then because everything was so controlled by these very small systems that said, okay, you can do this and we'll put you on radio. And now it does, none of that matters.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, now you can literally be that guy in like Minneapolis in your basement, like making a song, and somehow you put it out to the world. And sometimes it can truly have that organic viral moment where you're in your basement and all of a sudden like 50,000, 100,000 people have heard your song. I mean, that's that access, you know, we're talking about like, you don't sell records anymore. It's a blessing and a curse all at the same time. You know, they say now between 5 and 10 records are stolen for every one that's purchased. So in that way, you don't sell as many records. But at the same time, there's the internet, which we literally have fans in Bangladesh saying, "We love your music." You know, we can't afford to get over to Bangladesh, but somehow, somehow via the interwebs, you know, they know.
Is there another time period that you think, you know, it would have been great to have been a musician in this time period? Like, would you have wanted to be absorbed by the label system in the 70s?
Hell no. The 90s, when they were writing like seven-figure checks and you were seeing all these people, whatever. I mean, that's partially a joke, but I mean, it was pretty incredible back in the day when you could actually like sell a lot of records. You could go make a music video for more than like 10 cents being rubbed together. You know, there was like, there was a whole sort of thing. You know, we were on an indie for a long time and we just switched to a major, and I got to say that, you know, we made our record, finished it even before we switched. But being on a big corporation, you can also feel, you know, there's more power behind you. There's more support. You know, we were at a label with five people in the staff, and then we switched to a label that's got a couple hundred. And, you know, there's always 101 nightmare stories about major labels. But if you're actually in their good graces, it's not a bad thing.
What is it that they provide? Is it just like promotion,
support, staff, you know, just passion? You know, there's a couple hundred people that are passionate about, you know, helping your band and your music get out to the world, you know. And you know, it's palpable. You can feel it when you're promoting the record. You know, we just came off of like 4 weeks of going around to every radio station around the country, introducing ourselves, trying to get our songs played on the air and do the promotion dance that you got to do. And it, you know, that's part of that being even in that pathway to have those opportunities is direct result of being on a label, you know?
Oh yeah. I remember I worked at K-Rock in the 90s, and then when, you know, K-Rock was pretty very powerful in the 90s, 'cause they were, you know, they had grunge and they had, you know, like, they had a lot of the music that was at the top of the charts.
For sure.
And bands would come in and just play, live, like just play to try to like, hey, huh, how about this? You know?
Oh yeah, we just did that, hey, how about this, for K-Rock just a couple weeks ago.
Oh yeah?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's like, but now you play on the Red Bull stage. It's sponsored, which is not bad because our band, you know, when you're on the road, you need that extra taurine or whatever they put in there.
Oh, that's cool, because when I worked at K-Rock, it literally was just in a conference room. Like, they would come in and just play in a conference room.
No, now they've dressed it up with, like, some speakers and some paint.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. Oh, good. They painted it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. That's really good. Does that wear on you at all, or do you still have the excitement of like, no, we're still growing and we're still building it? Or are you like, oh my god, if I have to go to one more weird, you know, radio station in the mid, you know, somewhere and play again for music people, I would.
Oh, well, I think you definitely, like, the road is, you know, people think that being on the road as a musician is all glamour, but I always say it's 23 hours of shit for 1 hour of glory. You know, it's like you're busting your ass just getting from point A to point B. You're in a different city every 18 hours. You're just going, because every day you're out there, it costs a lot of money to be out there. So you can't lollygag. You know, you got to, like, just be going. And you're exhausted. That's the part. You can do anything until you're sleep deprived and like 3-4 days in a row of like 3 a.m. lobby calls and your ass is just whooped and you're dragging. But I'll say this is the incredible thing about music. You start playing it as a band. I even had it yesterday. We were doing a show and I was tired, but somebody sort of just went off on a solo and then everybody's energy just went through the roof. And it was that real creative moment of creation and that thing that you can't even sort of quantify or explain really, but it was just all of a sudden I went from exhausted to completely like euphoric.
Mm-hmm. What do you think happened for the you say the 20 years before this specific thing happened with the tantrums? Like, what was it? What were you trying to do, or what did you feel like when you look back now? Do you go, oh, well, of course that wouldn't have worked because I was trying too hard to pursue a trend, or I wasn't doing this, or I was...
I think, you know, I mean, the thing is like, I've been a singer my whole entire life, and then the sort of vibe that comes from that is you're like, well, if you can sing any style, what innately is you? What defines you? What is your true, authentic voice? Because you can sing any kind of style. And it took me a long time to, I think, find what that thing was, where it went from being imitation to, like, just personal, real, my voice. And I think that's one of the elements. You know, I'd say, you know, I mean, I grew up in L.A. It's such a weird city to grow up in. You see, like, basically everybody coming from every other city to this town to try and succeed, to make it. And, like, you grow up here, so you're like, well, where do I go? If everyone's coming, if this is the place you come, where do you go? And you see people rise and fall, and just the whole nature of the entertainment business, whatever paradigm that is. But it's also, it's one of the few places where, like, hard work doesn't amount to a guaranteed success. Usually somewhere else, like, you work at an office, you bust your ass, you're halfway smart, you succeed. That doesn't apply here in this town.
And I don't really think of, and I apologize, I'm about to offend a bunch of LA bands, but I don't really think of LA as a music town per se, in the sense where you go, like, oh, you go to Seattle, there's all these music clubs. Oh, you know, you go to Chicago, there's this kind of thing. Or you go to New York, you know. Like, I don't think of L.A. as like, oh, you got to go to L.A. because of all the music, you know.
Right.
Like, I don't really think of
sure.
L.A. as being like a any more than it was in the 80s.
It actually is. It just is always being eclipsed by the fact that it's the industry town.
Of course.
You know, and that was one of the benefits of my band. A lot of times it can be really hard to put a band together and find the right people, right vibe, right talent level, taste. And with Fits and the Tantrums, you know, we literally made 5 phone calls, and all of a sudden it was the pairing. We went and rehearsed, and it was on. But all those guys came from that authentic music scene here in L.A., you know. There's a whole sort of underground soul and funk and hip-hop scene that's happening continuously outside of the industry. And all those guys had played with each other in different combinations. So they really brought that sort of just road dog skill and veteran sort of ability that existed in that outside, in that real music community, and brought it to the band. And that was one of the reasons why we went from one rehearsal to playing at our first show a week later at Hotel Cafe.
I mean, it is almost kind of a, when you think about that, it is almost like an astronomy event, where it's like all these different things had their own paths, and then it took all those paths to bring them to this one point in time to make them ready to create this very specific kind of chemistry for this thing.
I totally agree. You know, I mean, it's like some of it was like finding your right voice. Some of it was finding the right people, good music, but also just that, like, stars aligning, like, whatever, you know. It's like we had all these magical things that happened at the beginning that said, like, okay, you've played 2 shows and now Flogging Molly wants to take you on the road and Maroon 5 wants to take you on the road, like 2 totally different bands. But we went and we did it. But, you know, at the same time, it was coupled with, like, the hardest amount of work that we've ever done. We, you know, like I said, nobody was in the industry was paying attention. So we just went and grinded it out. We did everything we should. We, you know, interviewed at the local newspaper to the local LA Weekly style paper in every town. I mean, we did everything and everything, and played shows in front of 5 people and dives in the middle of nowhere to playing to 500 people the next night, and just collected those fans 2, 3, 10 at a time. You know, it was, like I said, I think for everybody in the band, a huge point of pride is that we just worked our asses off to get to where we are.
Was there one thing that you did that you felt like, oh, this sort of tipped everything?
It's interesting because we did, like, you know, all the late night circuit last time. We did 2 Lenos. We did everything. And we also did this thing called Live from Daryl's House, which is Daryl Hall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Has his own thing, which I love because it had that same sort of, you know, do-it-yourself kind of vibe, is that, like, he was at his home in upstate New York, and he was like, I want to be creative. So he started inviting other musicians to his house. They jam some of his songs. They do some of his songs, their songs, excuse me. And they started putting it up on the internet, and it became this whole phenomenon. And doing Live from Daryl's House turned out to be maybe the single most important thing we've ever done, because wherever we go, whether we're in Australia or in Brussels or here in the States, people come up and they go, like, I found out about you because of Live from Daryl's House. And it was an incredible thing because it's people that are really hungry for an experience. It's not just like passive viewership, mm-hmm. you know, like watching something late night as you're passing out drunk or whatever. It's like people are going there for that musical
yeah.
experience. Like, let's go hang out with Todd Rundgren, or let's go hang out when we did our episode with Fits and the Tantrums and Daryl Hall and watch them make music. And it blows me away to this day. And it's like multi-generational, like mom and dad, their son, their daughter, all like getting into this and then all coming to the show. It's pretty incredible.
Did you cover a Hall & Oates song?
We did. Actually, we went, you know, because everybody, a lot of people that went on there, like Chromeo and stuff, they do all the like 80s hits that you know.
Yeah.
But actually, Hall & Oates, especially Daryl, started out as like some of the first true blue-eyed soul singers.
Yeah.
You know, he came out, like got his first contract with Gamble and Huff out of Philly, you know, and he was singing like in the same way that Todd Rundgren was, like real like white boys doing just legit soul. So we went and found the first song he ever performed that was actually the thing that won him his first talent show, a track called Girl, I Love You, and then this other song called Perky Omen. And he was just so happy that we went and found these like deep cuts from him, and as opposed to just doing Private Eyes like again.
Very creative on your part. That says a lot about your band.
Yeah, well, you know, and it was like, because especially our first record was very sort of influenced by 60s soul music. I mean, you know, for people that know like Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, they're like traditionalists. They do like 60s soul, Motown stacks, all that kind of stuff, like to a T. And she is one of the badass best singers and performers ever. But our music was sort of more of a weird hybrid of like soul music, but even more so like 80s British bands that were being influenced by soul music,
like ABC,
know, ABC, Style Council, all that, you know, Haircut 100, all that kind of music that was like, it was like once removed, you know, and that's sort of where we got our influences. But that's why we, when we went and hung out with Daryl, we said, okay, well, let's find the music that found his roots, which was that blue-eyed soul sort of vibe, and less of the 80s new wave. And I'd actually say on this record now, we've kind of embraced more of the 80s new wave part on this record. It's more of a progression. But
I fucking love that music so much. I mean, like, ABC's How to Be a Millionaire was I played the shit out of that. Because that was one of the first actual compact discs that you could buy, that I bought in the you know, like 86 maybe, 87, was How to Be a Millionaire. I played the fuck out of that.
Yeah, well, and if you grew up, where did you grow up?
I grew up in a lot of different cities, but I ended up in LA my senior year of high school, but I was in Denver before.
And I think we're close in age, so if you were around here, it was like K-Rock was the radio station for the whole country. They broke every 80s new wave and new romantic band.
Yeah, Rodney.
If you know even what new romantic is.
Rodney brought a lot of stuff. Rodney on the Raw.
You know, I mean, it's like all of that stuff. I loved it. Loved it. Violent Femmes, Haircut 100, ABC.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for us, this new record, there's a lot of tracks that I say are sort of like Martin Fry, ABC, Redux for 2013, sort of. Definitely taking a lot of influence from
them. They all had
world.
That, and they all, you know, the one thing that that the 90s kind of took away, or maybe it didn't take away, it just gave different costumes. But I feel like there was a certain there was a certain character element to 80s music. There was a certain theatrical, you know, and maybe it came out of like, you know, Elton John and Ziggy Stardust or whatever or Alice Cooper or whatever it came from. But then in the 80s, like, when I think about ABC, they had very specific characters, and there was like the bald guy with the round glasses, and then Moss and Fry, and then
like My Hairdo inspired the Flock of Seagulls. Come on.
yours is not even
I know. Mine is a tame version.
You're like a level 3 Seagulls. Like, it's not.
Exactly. Because he was a full 10. I mean, because he had 10. The side. This side was our, like, just straight up.
Yeah. And then all those, you know, all those theatrics went away. And I mean, I think when you look back, you go, okay, they just swapped out the costumes for flannel. Like, they were still costumes. They shed it all away. And I think, you know, even the idea of touring a band like ABC or like what you guys do, which is more of a fuller, bigger, like that late revival, 60s revival sound, is it tough now to tour that? Because it's not as just like, well, there's just three of us and it's cheap to tour. I mean, like, it must be a kind of a pain for you guys to tour.
Well, when you're doing like the festival circuit in the summer, you're looking at those DJs that literally are fucking rolling up. And I'm not joking. They're rolling up with a fucking USB stick. And you know those motherfuckers are getting paid like $250,000. And you're like, I fucking hate you.
I mean, I remember talking to a friend of mine who was in a band and this is even the 90s, and he'd go, yeah, you know, we just got offered you know, like a couple hundred grand to go play Australia. And I'm like, that's really awesome. And he goes, no, it's not. I mean, wait, because they were a big band. And he's like,
travel, hotel, transportation, commissions, food, crew. You know, it whittled all down, and they really all just walked away, you know, for a month or two.
Bucks.
I mean, literally, just like maybe a couple $1,000 for a lot of work, which
we should definitely not tell me or the rest of my band to go listen to this podcast, because that's the experience that we have. You know, there's six of us, and then you got a couple crew, and you got to get there. Point A, it's definitely more challenging. I mean, you have to work twice as hard to make a living at it.
Don't you remember when TLC did their Behind the Music and they were like, everyone thinks you make a lot of money, but you have, and they were like the first ones to really break it down.
About recoupment?
Yeah, and they're like, here's what you have to understand about how it works, you know, because people just think, oh, if you have one, it's like, oh, you're a crazy millionaire. It's like, no. There's so much, that money goes to so many different places. It's like, I always say, if you're in the entertainment business, if you want to make a shit ton of money, you have to make a fuck ton of money. Because 80, in some cases, to 80 to 90% of it will just go to everything, to other people.
Yeah, well, you know, there's, you know, in this world, there's a lot of people that got to help you. You know, you have managers, agents, publicists, accountant, you know, I mean, it's like whatever, the boring business side of it. But it's the shit where everybody's got to survive. And there's, you know, there's a lot of pieces to the pie that are split off.
But before people think that we're, you know, that we're luxury complaining, but in the end, you know, for me, I always sort of felt like, well, As long as I can make enough to keep doing what I want to do, then it'll be fine.
Exactly.
Then everything will be
well,
fine.
Well, you know, and I'd say the interesting thing about music and musicians is musicians get fucked in the ass more than anybody else. It's kind of crazy. You know, we get taken advantage of all the time. You know, people want you to do shit for free. They want to underpay you. It's really hard to make it and make a steady living in music. Like, even I was lucky. I fell into making music for commercials, and you can actually make a pretty decent living from doing that. But I went and had a meeting with a television show, some reality show. They were like, so yeah, we want you to make the music for the season. I'm like, cool. They're like, yeah, so it's like $8,000. I'm like, okay, $8,000 an episode. They basically want 44 minutes worth of wall-to-wall music. And they're like, oh, no. That's $8,000 for 16 episodes. And I'm like, that's less than a penny a minute of worth of music.
which will take you how many months to make?
Exactly. You know, it was insane. Musicians just get taken advantage of. It's one of those things. Even now, it's with the digital revolution, is the first people that the file sizes were small enough, and now it's happening to TV and movies, but you could steal music very easily, you know? And it was the first sort of victims of the internet and zeros and ones.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just say that if you can actually make it and pay your bills, and for us, that's six of us in the band, a couple crew, our extended family of our two managers that have been with us since the very beginning. We're all actually paying our rent now. And that is a blessing. You know, it's a truly kind of incredible.
I mean, especially as much as you tour, do you really, even if you had a massive house, it was you're never even in it anyway. The life of a musician, how much money do you need? It really is just, as long as you can make enough to keep going, and then maybe you'll have some later on down the road, so you don't, you know, so you don't die.
Yeah, well, and because people don't really buy records as much, the way you make a living is being on the road, and it's not like other things. Well, I guess it's when you're a comedian and you're going out and doing shows. You can only be one city at a time. You gotta go play one show at a time.
But again, but the comedian, a comedian's joy is basically, I don't even roll up with a USB stick.
Right, it's just you.
It's just there's no sound check. There's no, you know, unless I'm doing a theater, there's no crew. It's really, I just come in and, you know, people are eating wings. And I yell dick jokes at them. And so there's no real, you know, it's very easy for me. And so I know that. Versus what it must be like. I mean, even just the idea of having to rely on five other people to show up, be there, always be performing at the same level, all be kind of agreeing that we're moving all in the same direction. Like,
That is astonishing to me. Like, bands that stay together more than an album, I'm blown away by. Bands that stay together for decades, I don't know how the fuck they do that.
Oh, I know. I mean, it's a challenge. But, you know, it's like when you find the right combination of people, it's definitely easier. You know, I mean, we're all focused together. And I think it's part of the thing is that we're all not 21 and falling on our face over our own ego and being drunk every night. You know, it's
right.
Like we're all like professionals and we all work really hard and we all know what's at stake. You know, people have houses, have babies, have lives that they need to be responsible for. So yeah. It definitely can motivate you a little more than to be a total fuck up.
When you look back at all the is there one band or kind of musical experience that you were involved in where you look back and you go, oh no, oh man, are you happy with all of it?
No. Well, all I'll say is thank God that all of that stuff happened before the internet.
Because a constant reminder of your failures.
Nobody can like really just like post that shit and humiliate me over and over and over again. It's like in the past and it stays in the past, and that's I'm really grateful for that part of it. For sure.
Actually, you know, I know there was a half smirk when you were saying that, like it's almost a little like you're almost kidding, but maybe not.
Oh,
but
I don't think joking.
I don't think you like that is a very real. Can you imagine now what it's like to try to develop when you could all of a sudden be completely ridiculed and then maybe go, well, I'm probably not going to do this anymore because that was a horrible experience. Like, you were allowed to sort of fail and try and experiment without feeling like everyone was going to judge you.
Well, now I'm sure somebody's going to go dig somewhere and find some shit to put on the air.
But you're okay now.
Whatever. It'll survive.
You're okay now.
But, you know, even with my friends, you know, it's like I don't even tell my friends about shows. They're like, why didn't you tell me you did a concert in town? I'm like, dude, I spent so many years guilt tripping you people, begging you to show up at my fucking shows. And, you know, it was just like the worst feeling, like just guilt tripping 50 of your friends to show up.
Please
at the Viper Room.
Please just show up so we can perform.
So that, like, oh, you know, you don't have to pay to play at the Whiskey or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I just... That feeling is the worst feeling, so I don't even bother with that. The fact that we actually have fans that want to come and hang out and sing and they know the music and they're there, I'm like, I don't even bother telling my friends anymore.
I don't, a lot of times I don't, just because I always feel a little obnoxious if I haven't seen someone for a while and I call them and I go, hey, would you like to come see me on stage?
I know.
Like, it feels weird to say that.
It's a very weird
come
paradigm.
Watch me.
And even like with... You know, like, I've lived in this town my whole life, so I know a shit ton of people. I'm not friends with them, but I know a lot of people. I can never go out. My lady hates going out with me because I got to stop it. Hey, man, how you doing? You know, like, that conversation that you have to... You can't walk by them and ignore them, but, you know, and it just drives her crazy. But, shoot, I just totally...
Did your brain just take a vacation
my
for a second?
My brain just died.
You were going down a pathway, and then you went down a stairwell, and then you were like, I didn't leave a breadcrumb trail. I don't know where I was a second ago.
Now I remember.
Good. I'll just talk until someone remembers.
It's like, you know, that sort of thing now that we've had some success. It's like now people that just want to be like, so, congratulations. It's like the whole personal dynamic shifts from just regular conversations to now it's all about talking about what's happening with you or the success of the band. And that's, I think, is a similar thing where I'm not used to, like, I don't like that kind of attention, even though I'm like this lead singer of a band. Like, I don't like to kind of have to talk about myself in my personal life or be like, hey, yeah, come see my band, come, yeah, and this is happening for me. And
it's interesting you say that. Let's talk about your childhood. Where'd you go to high school?
I went to high school at Los Angeles County High School for the Arts in East LA. It was the first public arts high school in LA.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah.
Because I went to I moved out here my senior year. I went to a Loyola.
Oh, yeah.
Which is...
I went to Oakwood before that, which is in the Valley, which was sort of like the rich kid industry kid school where, like, I was the only kid whose parents weren't in the television business.
What did your parents do?
My dad was president of a university, CalArts, California Institute of the Arts.
Oh, my God. Holy shit. That's fucking huge. CalArts is like some of the greatest artists, animators, like, that's fucking...
But it's not TV.
Well, a lot of it becomes TV.
Well, it's crazy. That's kind of the way people saw it at Oakwood. But
CalArts is fucking
huge. And I actually, both myself and my brother, we went there, but after my dad left there, so because I couldn't handle like going there while he was still president.
Oh my God! I mean, like, just I was a huge animation nerd growing up, and so many of the like the wave of all, like the wave of 90s amazing cartoons and animation. Like a lot of those guys came out of CalArts.
Well, you know, and the sort of like untold history of CalArts is that CalArts was founded by the Disney family, but they did it in the early 70s where they basically somehow went and got the most radical artists to be the staff in the sort of the building of the place, like John Baldessari and what's the guy's name who literally his performance art was where he shot himself, Mike something. Anyway, so they started this school that they envisioned would just be like a nice little factory to like build like talented people for Disney. And what it turned out to be was like this radical art school that turned out to be the most cutting edge school in all of America, where people were like doing plays totally nude. And I think it just scared the crap out of them. And I think they wanted to kind of pull back from it a little, but at that point it would have been probably a PR nightmare. So they sort of still had to continue with it, and they moved up to Valencia right near Magic Mountain.
Yeah.
And then there became this sort of division where there was like two schools. There was the animation school, and then there was the rest of the school. And it was sort of like...
the rest.
Yeah, well, it was like all the other things, like whether you were dance or experimental film or fine arts or whatever. But there was this real division. There was sort of... I always found it weird, but there was this sort of like snobbery from the rest of the school where it was like, oh, you guys are animators. You guys are working towards actually getting paid when you get out of here.
Right.
It was this weird sort of tension. And they had their own department. And the thing was that they all won because they actually got jobs right when they left the school. You know, they actually had like the like work conventions where like you,
they
like
were learning a skill. They were learning a trade.
Yeah. And they you know, and I mean, there's a lot of amazing new animation that's come out of that school.
Incredible. And Valencia is such an interesting place because you have Magic Mountain, CalArts, and then the porn industry. Like there's this weird all these three completely separate things
and
around
post,
Valencia.
And post-riot, the quickest expanding white community in all of California.
Just, they really just went out to Valencia.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's actually true. You know, it's like after the riots, I think people just like, there was this crazy white flight that happened.
White Flight. That's a fucking name for a band. Yeah. Or an album. No, actually, White Flight sounds... That actually sounds a little supremacy. That's probably not a good. Don't call it. Don't name a band White Flight, unless it's about a polar bear and he has wings. But otherwise, it's going to sound too racial. What did you do for the riots? Do you remember where you were?
I was actually going to CalArts. I was studying experimental film, which was like the most awesome education you could ever have because it has so many applications in the real world.
Of course.
And that's actually where I put my first band together. We went in and recorded at the studio at the school, came out, laid down my vocals, and that was the first time I understood that process of being in the studio and recording and heard my voice with the recording. And I fell back in love with music, which I had studied in high school. And I called my dad and said, yeah, you know those 4 years of film school education you just paid for? Yeah, I'm just going to go back to music.
But do you understand that it's the perfect, as the president of CalArts, he can't be like, no. Ugh.
I know. He's like, God damn, I have to be supportive.
What was that band called? Do you remember?
What was that band called? I think it was called Remedy.
Remedy.
Remedy. It was the 90s. You guys got to forgive me. And it was totally like...
opening for Fuel.
It was a bunch of the jazz musicians playing like prog rock, like prog heavy metal kind of like in weird time signatures.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
just the most like nerdy music that nobody else could love, but that, other musicians.
That you're experimenting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember I had a class. I was kind of walking around there's a little at UCLA campus where I went to college. There's a little like arboretum. There's like a little garden, and I got back to my apartment, and my roommate's just glued to the TV, and he's like, "There's some serious shit going down. There's like a riot." And it was that footage of like. Like Reginald Denny getting pulled out of the truck, and they're like, "Oh fuck!" And then it just tumbled,
spiraled. Because I lived in Hollywood, I lived right at Wilton and Franklin.
Oh yeah,
And you could just see six plumes of smoke going all the way down Sunset Boulevard, and it was like, whoa, this is getting real.
Yeah.
And then we were like, let's go drive around.
Like Sean Penn did. Sean Penn drove to the riots in his Porsche. That's the story that I heard. That's,
did he really?
I totally believe it.
Yeah, believe that.
And then I mean, God damn it. You know, well, we were college kids. What the fuck? We'd basically just hold up in a friend's apartment building.
Smoked weed.
Yeah, we just got drunk. Basically just got drunk. I mean, we were just...
That's what I did.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was he was in a security building. We're like, well, we'll probably be okay. But it was so crazy because...
Remember the very special Doogie Howser that was during the riots?
No.
I do.
What was the very special Doogie Howser?
Well, Doogie was taking care of this guy who had looted a store, and he had a moral dilemma about it. You know, it's during the riots in L.A. I didn't know Doogie Howser took place in L.A. until that episode. But
And that was very special.
Yeah, it was very special.
This guy's building was one of the taller buildings in Westwood, in the little community of apartments where all the students live. And it was I remember just being really weird, just being on the roof and looking out and just seeing, like, fucking... military vehicles in the streets and no people, because Westwood at that time, well, still I guess, but Westwood at that time was just like always. Westwood was a little shaky. In the mid '80s, Westwood was very popular. Then the New Jack City riots happened, and then Westwood got unpopular for a while. Do you remember the New Jack City riots?
Of course.
Yeah. So that ruined Westwood for a few years. People rioted after the movie New Jack City in Westwood, and people got shot
at the movie
because
theater,
it was that
it was
bad. The movie was that bad. They were
New
like,
Jack City's a good movie. What are you talking about? I'm Pookie. You're Pookie. We're all Pookie. Don't you remember? Right, fucking so Judd Nelson.
Explain this more to me. What happened?
There was a drive-by shooting. There was some sort of a shooting at the movie theater for New Jack City. I don't know if the theater
like
was
at
oversold.
The Westwood. Like, was it the premiere or something? Or?
I don't know. It wasn't the premiere. It was just a screening of New Jack City. And so there were shootings, and there was a thing, and a mini incident that happened. And so Westwood went dark, like it just went dead for a couple years because, you know, all the people were like, oh, we can get shot? Okay, well, we're not going to go walk the streets. And so Westwood died a little bit.
Wow.
And then came back, and then the riots happened, and then it got weird again for a little while.
Well, Westwood, I feel Westwood's back now.
Westwood's way back now, yeah.
I have not been there in like 15 years.
I went there maybe like a year ago. I kind of walked through, and some of the shops are different, but it fucking feels exactly the same.
It's so weird, like growing up here. I live even further east. I live in Silver Lake, and it's like I just was in Malibu yesterday for this benefit, and I was like, this is literally my yearly journey to the West Side.
It is.
Like, I never go to
easier
the West
to get
side.
To Las Vegas than from Silver Lake to Malibu.
Kind of.
Oh, easier bit, to fly bit. To Las Vegas.
You just don't want to get on the other side of the 405. You just don't want to do it.
My manager lives there. I'm just hating on his.
What
boo.
Is wrong with you?
How could you live on the West Side?
He really. And this is like one of like the guy who no more 90s rock than this dude. Like he was Hollywood in the 90s rock and roll scene.
And now
he's just totally booged out in the boo.
Drifted west for gourmet markets and. Yeah, here it's
so telling of the Santa Monica Farmers Market to happen during the week and then like in the morning.
Oh yeah,
like just fuck it, it's on a Tuesday.
This is probably as far east as he's come in a while then, because you don't ever you're like if you're east or west, you just don't cross that barrier.
To me,
often.
West is like La Brea.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you start getting past La Brea, and you're like, ah, these furniture stores.
It's weird.
It starts to feel weird. Very local references for people who aren't from Los Angeles.
Local ref.
Local refs. And so now you're in town today when your album actually, when we're recording this, your album comes out tomorrow, but you must be about to leave for a while.
Yeah. I mean, we, you know, it took us all of last year to make the album. The album's called More Than Just a Dream. And, now just putting back the armor because we know, like last time we didn't know what was happening and we just sort of were blindly going day by day with the growing of the band and the success of it. This time we know what's ahead of us, which is basically we're going to be on the road for a couple years.
Wow.
And sometimes it definitely like you're like, wow, okay, how am I gonna like wrap my head around that? And you literally just have to take it kind of week by week. You know, for us, you know, this week it's the launch of the record. We're doing Kimmel tomorrow and stuff like that. So it's like a nice break to be at home and hang out a little bit and get those last few moments of like normalcy before we go and be traveling Wilburys again.
Oh, yes. Handle me with care. The traveling Wilburys.
Super band. I mean, come on.
There's no question. I kind of miss the traveling Wilburys. Yeah, you got Dylan, you got Orbison, you got Jeff Lynne.
Gosh, come on. That's some curly hair in that band.
How do you...
totally.
They should have...
I love how Jeff Lynne still rocks it. Just fucking rocks the down to here.
How was that
shit.
Never like a L'Oreal commercial? Even the name Handle Me With Care, and then all their gorgeous hair.
We have a YouTube channel. We can make that happen.
We can make it happen. how do you balance between, you know, going out to support the album that you've just released, maintaining that, but then also... Now, you know, within that 2 years, you're going to have to be looking ahead. You're going to be writing new stuff. You're going to have to be looking at that. Like, how do you process all of that at the same time?
You know, it's like, I don't know how, actually, honestly. You just sort of have to do everything, you know, in your power to survive, you know. It's like, you know, this band made it through hard work, and it's not like we're a household name by any stretch. I mean, we've definitely had success. But, you know, it's still like it's a battle. We're on the battlefield just trying to like, you know, crack open those flares and do the like, the big waving of like, you know.
The Nicolas Cage and The Rock.
Yes.
Yeah.
Am I weird for loving that movie?
No, you're not weird.
Like, I fucking love that. Like, I love a great action. When it's a good action movie, I was in.
You were in, way in.
And for me, like, on the road, like, there's so much travel. There's so many, like, grinding hours that, like, now I'm just, like, binge watch television shows and, like, I'm re-going through, like, every movie on my iPad just so I don't have to deal with the, like, 2-hour layover, the 4-hour plane ride, the 4-hour bus ride. Like,
well, I got good news for you. Frasier is on Netflix. Frasier. All 264 episodes.
Well, there you go, right there. That's 11.
I've seen at least 260 of them.
That's 130 hours, right there. I mean, you know, so you could be in
like now. I just try and watch like all these new shows just weekly. Like I'm trying to just be patient with Game of Thrones, and it's driving me crazy.
It's hard, especially because we're spoiled now, and it's very difficult to go back to waiting.
You did on your TV episode. I saw you when you had the creator of Walking Dead, and
Kirkman.
I literally hid myself in my room for like 4 days with my lady, and we watched every single episode over the course of 5 days.
Wow, that is commitment.
It's fun to do that. It's fun to binge watch stuff.
If our show can do one thing, it's make people lock themselves in a room for 5 days.
Are you doing a bus tour? Are you doing the tour bus?
We are. It depends. Sometimes we're like flying city to city, which is brutal. And then I love being on the bus because even though you're like eight of you sleeping in bunk beds in this like mobile long hallway, at least you have like a home base that every city's changing every day. But at least you have a little bit of consistency and you go to bed at night and wake up in the next city.
Yeah. You know, I've always wanted to do a tour bus. It's a little bit harder for comedians.
Fun for about 24 hours, and then you're like, oh, right. It's like I'm sleeping on like a mobile, like, it's not all it has been.
And can you, you know, and I always think, okay, so they're just giving me this bus driver. What do I really know about this guy?
Oh, trust me. We watched that guy for a couple of days, and we're like, we had one last summer where the guy, because they're supposed to drive all night and then go to their hotel room and sleep all day while you're doing the work. And then you go to bed and they drive all night. And that's the sort of trade-off. And we had this one guy, he had like, you know, snakeskin cowboy hat, and he never slept. So we'd get to the city and then he'd just pull out a lawn chair and sit in front of the bus and drink Rockstar drinks all day long.
Oh no.
And then get back on the bus, and I swear to God, you just don't sleep that easy, you know, at night. You're just like, please God, just get us to the next city safe.
I know, especially in a vehicle that size, it doesn't really take much of like, you know.
Oh, I know. I mean, and you can feel when they're barreling down the highway, you know, like you can feel when they're going over like 65, you can start to feel like the car, everything just starts
gets a little lighter,
bouncing,
gets
rocking
a little
and rolling.
Yeah. And you sort of, it drifts a little bit, and you feel like those little things on the side of the, like, hey, get in the middle, stay in the middle. Yeah, I don't know. That's,
and you're in literally laying in a bunk bed in a hallway with no windows. It's like the darkest room you've ever slept in your life. And you're like, no sense of what's happening on the outside world.
What am I in? Am I in a high-speed coffin right now? It feels like I'm in a high-speed coffin.
It does actually feel like that sometimes.
But I just think it would be fun. I just want to do it and just like fucking take the Xbox, just set up a little, you know, just a little mobile Wi-Fi.
They had an Atari and Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
On the bus.
But now we can have an Xbox.
Oh, God damn it.
Yeah, but see, like, my relationship with gaming began and ended with Sonic the Hedgehog.
Oh, really?
Because my friend gave me the system. Which system was that?
Sega Genesis. Yes.
And, I mean, this is so dating myself, but who cares? It's past the point anyways. So they gave me the game and the Sonic, and I got so fucking good at that game that one game would last me 4 hours. And I'd get to the last board, the last thing to complete the whole thing, and I would die every time. And I'd be like, so like, oh, shaking my fist to the gods that I'd be like, okay, one more game. I know I'm going to do it. Two games, 9 hours later, I was like, I have no life. And I finally had to just give it. I'm a very addictive personality, so I can't do anything in moderation. I literally had to give it back after 4 months because all I did was try and perfect Sonic the Hedgehog.
And then fortunately, you were able to refocus those efforts on music.
Yes.
Otherwise, Fits and the Tantrums would be the greatest Sega Genesis team still keeping it real.
I'm just going to make an album of just 8-bit sounds.
You could. Chiptunes.
Oh, yeah. There's a bunch of them, right?
You could do that. The theme to this podcast is a group called Onomatoguchi. It's all chiptunes.
Yeah, I've heard them.
Yeah, they're fucking awesome. I would like to think that even after 20 years, you would be the greatest Sega Genesis team. You're like, so did you finally beat Sonic? I'm like, no. Still, after all these years, I get to the last.
I feel like that last board, they just make it impossible.
Could be a kill screen.
Could be.
Yeah.
There's a kill screen.
Kill screen coming up.
You want to see a kill screen coming up? If you get, you should watch
King of Kong
if you haven't seen it.
Ever done in public. Yeah.
King of Kong is a fucking amazing movie if you haven't seen it yet.
Oh, no, I
haven't. And if you're going to be sitting on a bus, you might as well watch
King of Kong.
It's a documentary about the two best donkey players.
Donkey Kong.
Steve Wiebe and Billy Mitchell.
Yep.
Wow.
So good.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad that we're all of the same sort of era. So
I'm happy for you to get to experience that movie for the first time. Like, that's how good that movie is.
Yeah, it is. It really is. And you don't really have to. I mean, obviously, if you like games, it's really fun. But you don't really.
No,
you don't necessarily have to.
No.
And it's. I think you will be very.
It's just too dangerous for me. Like, I won't have a personal life if I let myself ever get on to games.
That's funny. All the behind the musics of this generation will be like, and then he discovered Call of Duty, and you know, like it used to be heroin, and now it's fucking like World of Warcraft. Or Xbox, or you know.
I mean, I did have my little second revisiting with it when all the like app games came out, and just got a little too deep into that.
Especially,
world.
You know, if you're sitting around for a while, you got to distract yourself because who wants to be with their thoughts?
Yeah.
Not me.
Nobody wants to just be sitting in an airport for two hours just thinking about stuff.
It's great for relationships, I'll tell you that.
We're both distracted. I know, it's funny. Chloe and I, like, well, you know, we'll have dinner together, we'll watch something together, and then I find, like, all of a sudden we've been sitting in bed next to each other for an hour and haven't talked because we're both on our laptops, you know, just, like, completely, like, zoned out and isolated.
Oh, I know. I sometimes, like, literally when me and my lady are, like, texting each other, like, weird memes from across the house, and we're in the same house, it's a little weird, you know, it's like, okay, put down the PDA. Wow.
PDA?
Yeah.
Wow. Which is really, I could only
really
date myself more if I said versatile.
I said mimeograph yesterday, and Chloe was like, what the fuck is a mimeograph? And I'm like, it was a giant analog drum where people would make copies of things with carbon. Good night. And then I just went to bed.
Exactly.
We're so addicted to our devices, you just start making out, and then you text your girlfriend, take your pants off. And then she texts back, so frowny face. So the album comes. Album's out, by the time this is out, the album is out.
That's right.
Available on all of the typical places that people would find their music.
That's right. iTunes, Amazon. You can go to our website and get it there. And
do a vinyl release.
Yeah, we did. We do a lot of work with indie record stores, and we actually, for Record Store Day, we did a cool like limited edition of the single with clear see-through vinyl, which. That for me, I was just like goo goo gaga over being able to actually see our record with like. It's the specialty 180 gram vinyl and stuff. But we always go and hang out. I mean, indie record stores have been so much a part of like our story and supporting us as a band. So we always go and do like weird little in-stores at indie record stores and play there in between the old CDs.
So looking ahead, what is it that you, you know, as we kind of wrap this up, what is it that you want ultimately? Like when you're a young artist, I think you, you know, you're a young performer, you go, yeah, I just want this big thing to happen. And you may not even know exactly what it is, but it's just this big thing. And success is this relatively undefined concept where it's like, I just want that thing. So, you know, has that idea changed since you started? What is it? What would make you happy?
Well, I think, you know, the thing is, it's weird when you've spent your whole life working towards something. You know, I mean, the music business broke my heart so many times over that, like, when the success of this band started to happen, I really had to address the fact that, wow, I just had some deep wounds even from that world. Like, I had been beaten down by the business. I still couldn't even wrap my head around that this moment was happening for myself and for the band. And now I think it's like the weird thing is you actually get when you're one of those very few people that's fortunate enough to have their dream come true, you don't really get to be cynical anymore. And that's such a trippy sort of thing. Like, I'm used to being like a jaded, cynical motherfucker. And I can't be that guy anymore because I was like so lucky that I finally got to have everything I've wanted come true. And for me now, it's just a question of how much. And I have to, on a daily basis, sort of just remind myself to see how fortunate we are. And, you know, I mean, look, I'm ambitious. I want to, you know, I want to play the world. I want everybody to know our music. I want us to play arenas, you know, and have, you know, worldwide success. But at the same time, it's like we're already there. It's just a matter of how much. And if you just stay in the moment with it, then it's like you can enjoy the ride. Because if I'm always looking forward, I'm actually not enjoying what's already here and happening. And, you know, with everything, it's going to go away at some point. You know, they're going to stop loving you at some point. I've lived in this town, like we're talking about. I've seen that moment come and go for many people in many different parts of the business. So it's like I'm literally just holding on to the rocket ship and just trying to enjoy the ride as much as possible.
And that is almost the most perfect way to stick the landing for the end of the podcast, because we constantly remind people to not live in the past or the future, but to enjoy the present. So we end every episode by saying, enjoy your burrito, which is basically what you just described.
It is, and thank God I love a burrito.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go get burritos. Thanks, Fitz. Good to see you, man.
Dude, thank you so
Pleasure.
Much. Awesome.
Good luck
awesome.
With the tour.
Thank you, brother.
And good luck with the album. And now we'll turn this off, and I want to ask questions about CalArts.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by LegalZoom.com. Whatever your legal document needs, LLCs, wills, trusts, trademarks, and more, they've got it. Over 12 years and 2 million Americans have used LegalZoom. Start your business or protect your family today at LegalZoom.com using the offer code Nerdist.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.